Witz.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from Alice Bryant, Dan Friedel, and Mario Ritter Jr. Later, Jill Robbins answers a question from a learner on this week's Ask a Teacher. We close with an American story. This week, we present part 3 of Edgar Allan Poe's William Wilson. But first, here are Alice and Dan.
The town of Bentonia, in the southern state of Mississippi, has fewer than 500 people. But it is known as the birthplace of a special style of blues music. One musician is doing what he can to keep the music and storytelling tradition alive. Jimmy Duck Holmes is 73 years old. He is the last remaining Bentonia blues musician. He was just nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Traditional Blues Album. The album is called Cypress Grove. Holmes hopes Cypress Grove will help save the Bentonia blues long after he is gone. The world has changed around Holmes and his Blue Front Cafe, the country's oldest surviving juke joint. Across the South, these spaces were historically owned and visited by African Americans. But many juke joints have closed as owners have passed away. Blues experts believe Holmes is the only American operating a juke joint passed down by his parents. The Grammy Awards take place this year on March 14th. Holmes plans to watch the ceremony from the Blue Front Cafe. He cannot go to the event in person because of the coronavirus pandemic. Instead, he will be surrounded by musicians from across Mississippi who want to perform with him. I'll be here in this hole in the wall every day for as long as I can so that people don't forget, Holmes said. We're trying to make sure it doesn't die.
Holmes's parents opened Blue Front in 1948, when Holmes was just a baby. It was the first black-owned business in Bentonia. At the time, the town was mainly a community of black farmers. Holmes's parents, Carrie and Mary, were sharecroppers. Mary ran the Blue Front during the day, while Holmes worked with his father in the fields. By the time he was 9, Holmes was operating farming equipment by himself. The Holmes's business was a community gathering place. People came to have their clothing pressed, get a haircut, or buy salt, pepper, and other food products. And they came for the blues. Musicians stood in line outside, waiting to perform there. During cotton picking season, the Blue Front was open 24 hours a day to serve farm workers. They came in to eat Mary's famous buffalo fish. On weekends, people stayed all night drinking, dancing, and playing music. The town was never home to more than 600 people, but its location on the Illinois Central Railway brought visitors. Later, the only roadway between the southern cities of Memphis and Jackson passed through Bentonia. That made the town more popular. Historians who traveled through Mississippi to document blues musicians discovered Bentonia's style. Its use of minor key musical notes gave it a sound unlike the better-known blues styles. Growing up, Holmes learned music from his neighbor, Henry Stuckey. Stuckey is known as the father of the Bentonia Blues. He was an aging World War I veteran and played music for Holmes and his 13 brothers and sisters. The Bentonia style is passed from one musician to the next. It cannot be learned through written music. The old timers I learned from couldn't read, and they couldn't read sheet music, said Holmes, who also does not read music. Dan Auerbach produced Holmes's album Cypress Grove. He is also a member of the band The Black Keys. He said, "The beauty of Holmes's music is the improvisation. Those songs, they're like a living organism almost. They're changing daily," he said. "You can feel the realness and the immediacy of the music. And that's what makes it so special."
Today, a four-lane highway moves traffic away from Bentonia. Many businesses have closed down. Buildings have been torn down. More than 25% of the population lives below the poverty line. The train passes through town every day, but it does not stop. Holmes never imagined leaving Bentonia. He lives on the same farm where he was raised, about a kilometer and a half from the Blue Front Cafe. He has become Bentonia's biggest draw. Visitors come from all over the world to see him. They want to hear the music and learn the tradition. Before the pandemic, Mississippi musicians performed at the Blue Front every other Friday, sometimes more. They played different blues styles. Holmes holds Bentonia Blues workshops, and every day that he is at the Blue Front, he is willing to teach anyone who walks in. Some fans are surprised that he is so easy to reach, said Robert Connolly Farr. The Mississippi native, who now lives in Canada, has been visiting Holmes for guitar lessons for many years. Farr said, "I think it's important to Jimmy that this place is open and that it always has music and life in it." Holmes has performed in Europe, South America, and across the U.S. He opened for the Black Keys in Washington, D.C. in 2019. But he always comes back home. Holmes said that no young people in Bentonia want to learn the Bentonia style. They say it is too complex. They do not realize how every style of American music has roots in the blues, he said. But he keeps extra guitars around the Blue Front just in case someone wants to play. "It will survive somehow," Holmes said as he sat in his empty juke joint. "I learned enough that I was able to carry it on, and probably once I'm gone, somebody will be sitting around here playing, someone who picked up the things that I was doing." I have to hope. I have to hope. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
The World Health Organization warns that 25% of the world's population, or 2.5 billion people, will have hearing problems by 2050. The warning came from the first ever report on hearing from the United Nations Health Agency. The report found that many of the causes of hearing loss are preventable. They include infections, disease, birth defects, too much noise, and lifestyle choices. To fight hearing loss, the report suggests measures which, it says, could cost what is equal to $1.33 for every person each year. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the cost of doing nothing is very high, an estimated $1 trillion. The UN researchers estimate that 1 in 5 people around the world already have hearing problems. But the report warned the number may increase to 2.5 billion people during the next 30 years. And 700 million would require some kind of treatment for hearing loss by 2050. The UN experts say in the report that many people with hearing loss cannot get care. This is especially a problem in poor countries where there are fewer health care professionals. 80% of people with hearing loss live in poor countries. The report finds that, among those countries, 78% have fewer than one ear, nose, and throat specialist for every million people. The numbers are similar for specialists who treat hearing, speech therapists, and teachers for the deaf. The report adds that even in rich countries, the ability to get hearing treatment is uneven. It said there is a lack of good information and a stigma surrounding hearing problems that prevents people from getting treatment. Even among healthcare providers, knowledge relevant to prevention, early identification and management of hearing loss and ear disease is commonly lacking. The report proposes active measures for solving the problem. It recommends public health campaigns aimed at reducing loud noise. It also calls for increased vaccinations against diseases like meningitis, which have been linked to hearing loss. Other recommendations include systematic examination of people to identify problems at different points in their lives. For example, the report notes that 60% of hearing problems in children could be prevented. Programs to identify possible problems that target new mothers and babies can help too. In addition, recent technological improvements, including easy-to-use tools, can identify ear disease and hearing loss at any age. It is now easier to carry out screening in difficult conditions like those found during the coronavirus health crisis and in underserved areas of the world. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
This week, we answer a question from Ali in Iran. He wrote to us after reading a previous Ask a Teacher about security and safety. Dear VOA, could you explain the grammar related to the word "its" in this sentence?
Security often has to do with a group's efforts to protect its members from harm.
Dear Ali, thank you for writing to us. In the sentence you read, the word "its" is a possessive adjective, meaning belonging to it. And the "it" in this sentence is the group. Other possessive adjectives are words like his, her, my, your, our, and their. These words appear before a noun, like most adjectives in English, and change the meaning of the noun. Here is another example of how to use its.
I cannot drive that car. Its tires are flat. The queen wears a beautiful crown. Its jewels shine in the sun.
We can use words like its to take the place of a noun, as in this example.
I have large eyes, and so does my dog. Mine are blue, and its are brown.
Many English learners confuse the possessive form its with the short form its, it apostrophe s. The short form its is what we call a contraction. Its can be the short form of the word it is or it has. Here are some examples where its is the short form of it is.
It's great to see you again. I think it's time for dinner.
Compare these sentences with its as the short form of it has.
It's been years since I met with my high school friends. With daily practice, it's gotten easier for them to speak English.
I hope this helps you understand the different ways we use its, Ali. And that's Ask a Teacher. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Jill Robbins.
William Wilson, Part 3.
You will remember that in the last part of my story, I told of my experiences in my first school. I spoke of my early meetings with a boy who looked and behaved as I did, whose name was even the same as mine, William Wilson. I told of the night when I went to Wilson's room with a plan to hurt him. What I saw that night so frightened me that I left the room and the school forever. As I stood looking down at his sleeping form and face, I might have been looking at myself in a looking-glass. It was not like this, surely not like this, that he appeared in the daytime. The same name, the same face, the same body, the same day of coming to school, and then his use of my way of walking, my manner of speaking. Was it in truth humanly possible that what I now saw was the result, and the result only, of his continued efforts to be like me? Afraid, I left the old school and never entered it again. After some months at home, doing nothing, I went to study at the famous school called Eton. I had partly forgotten my days at the other school, or at least My feelings about those days had changed. The truth, the terrible truth of what had happened there, was gone. Now I doubted what I remembered. Now I called the subject into my mind only to smile at the strength of the strange ideas and thoughts I had once had. My life at Eton did not change this view. The fool's life into which I carelessly threw myself washed away everything that was valuable in my past. I do not wish, however, to tell here the story of my wrongdoing, wrongdoing which went against every law of the school and escaped the watchful eyes of all the teachers. 3 years of this had passed, and I had grown much larger in body and smaller in soul. 3 years of wrongdoing had made me evil. One night I asked a group of friends who were as evil as I to come to a secret meeting in my room. We met at a late hour. There was strong drink, and there were games of cards, loud talking until the new day began appearing in the east. Warm with the wine and with the games of chance, I was raising my glass to drink in honor of some especially evil idea when I heard the voice of a servant outside the room. He said that someone had asked to speak with me in another room. I was delighted. A few steps brought me into the hall of the building. In this room no light was hanging, but I could see the form of a young man about my own height, wearing clothes like those I myself was wearing. His face I could not see. When I had entered, he came quickly up to me, and taking me by the arm, he said softly in my ear, "William Wilson." There was something in the manner of the stranger and in the trembling of his uplifted finger which made my eyes open wide. But it was not this which had so strongly touched my mind and heart. It was the sound of those two simple, well-known words, "William Wilson," which reached into my soul. Before I could think again and speak, he was gone. For some weeks I thought about this happening. Who and what was this Wilson? Where did he come from? And what were his purposes? I learned that for family reasons he had suddenly left the other school on the afternoon of the day I myself had left it. But in a short time I stopped thinking about the subject. I gave all my thoughts to plans for study at Oxford University. There I soon went. My father and mother sent me enough money to live like the sons of the richest families in England. Now my nature showed itself with double force. I threw aside all honor. Among those who spent too much money, I spent more, and I added new forms of wrongdoing to the older ones already well known at the university. And I fell still lower. Although it may not be easily believed, it is a fact that I forgot my position as a gentleman. I learned and used all the evil ways of those men who live by playing cards. Like such skilled gamblers, I played to make money. My friends trusted me, however. To them, I was the laughing but honorable William Wilson, who freely gave gifts to anyone and everyone, who was young and who had some strange ideas, but who never did anything really bad. For 2 years I was successful in this way. Then a young man came to the university, a young man named Glendinning, who, people said, had quickly and easily become very rich. I soon found him of weak mind. This, of course, made it easy for me to get his money by playing cards. I played with him often. At first, with the gambler's usual skill, I let him take money from me. Then my plans were ready. I met him one night in the room of another friend, Mr. Preston. A group of 8 or 10 persons were there. By my careful planning, I made it seem that it was chance that started us playing cards. In fact, it was Glendinning himself who first spoke of a card game. We sat and played far into the night, and at last the others stopped playing. Glendinning and I played by ourselves while the others watched. The game was the one I liked best, a game called Ecarte. Glendinning played with a wild nervousness that I could not understand, though it was caused partly, I thought, by all the wine he had been drinking. In a very short time he had lost a great amount of money to me. Now he wanted to double the amount for which we played. This was as I had planned, but I made it seem that I did not want to agree. At last I said yes. In an hour he had lost 4 times as much money as before. For some reason his face had become white. I had thought him so rich that losing money would not trouble him, and I believed this whiteness, this paleness, was the result of drinking too much wine. Now, fearing what my friends might say about me, I was about to stop the game when his broken cry and the wild look in his eyes made me understand that he had lost everything he owned. Weak of mind and made weaker by wine, he should never have been allowed to play that night. But I had not stopped him. I had used his condition to destroy him. The room was very quiet. I could feel the icy coldness in my friends. What I would have done, I cannot say, for at that moment the wide, heavy doors of the room were suddenly opened. Every light in the room went out. But I had seen that a man entered. He was about my own height, and he was wearing a very fine long coat. The darkness, however, was now complete, and we could only feel that he was standing among us. Then we heard his voice. In a soft, low, never-to-be-forgotten voice, which I felt deep in my bones, he said, "Gentlemen, I am here only to do my duty. You cannot know the true character of the man who has tonight taken a large amount of money from Mr. Glendinning. Please have him take off his coat, and then look in it very carefully." While he was speaking, there was not another sound in the room. And as he ended, he was gone.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.